So I'm going to start now. Can you guys hear me? Supposedly the mic is on. Is that okay? All right. One announcement. There will be no class Friday. You almost got me there. So John was supposed to start talking to you about the semantics of programming languages, but he said it doesn't make sense to start on a Friday. And then you guys break for the weekend, and you don't have all the things in your head fresh. So I'm going to give a lecture on Thursday. Then Friday, do whatever you like with your time. And he will be back Monday. Okay? Our webpage will be updated, and he will send all of you an email saying what I just said, because, of course, not everybody who is taking this course is here. Although today I see some more people. I counted 45. Usually the number is a bit less. Anyway, okay. So let's move on. Today we will talk about natural languages. So Friday's lecture was mostly about, you know, the semantics of programming languages, because these are the things you're mostly familiar with. And we talked about, you know, how is the semantics defined, how we can actually come up with the semantics of programming languages. And this is all nice and, you know, relatively straightforward. This lecture is about the non-very straightforward part, which is how do we compute a meaning representation for natural language. Okay, so, hello. So, this talk is structured in three parts, all of them equally interesting or important, I would say. The first part is building up towards what do we mean by representing the meaning of language? If I ask you right now, what is this meaning of language? I had a lecture once and they were joking. You were asking them, what is the meaning of life? And they said, life itself. So what do we mean by meaning? Right? It could be a couple of things. We're clear what we mean by syntax, right? Syntax, to most people, would mean trees. Now, today, we'll see what it means to have meaning for natural language. Now, semantics, which is the field that studies language meaning, is concerned with how expressions in a language map to a world, the real world, the one we live in. And it's interested both in the denotation, and this is the literal meaning, this is what mostly we're concerned with, and the connotation, which is other associations. And I'll give you an example. When you read the news and there is captions of the images, these images most of the times are connotative, so they're not literal. They tell you things that you couldn't possibly guess by looking at the image. For example, they have some person there and their head has been chopped off, and they say, like, nice Christmas present. This you can't tell from the image, so it's other associations that we have. We are not going to talk about non-literal meanings here. I'm just raising this in case you tell me, oh, wait a minute, language is so much more than what you are going to do in this lecture. Now, when we say in everyday usage, a sentence is ambiguous, we mean that it has more than one literal meaning. And we've talked a lot about ambiguity in natural language, something that doesn't thankfully arise in formal languages. And there is three sources of ambiguity. Some ambiguity comes from words having more than one sense, right? For example, the word date could be the fruit, could be let's have the date, or it could be the date of the week, Tuesday. Some ambiguity comes about because sentences have more than one parse tree. And we've seen a lot of that in this course. Attachment ambiguities, relative clause ambiguities, things that make the sentence have different structures. And there's a third ambiguity we will be talking about today and on Thursday, and this is called scope. And we'll see what this means. It has to do with the meaning of natural languages. Now, how does meaning come about? We cannot entirely eliminate syntax, right? Because syntax is the working blocks of language, and they're building together longer sentences. And so somehow we have to take syntax into account when we are doing semantics. And I should preface whatever I'm going to say today, this is a view of semantics, which if you take natural language understanding, which is a fourth year course, you will see that it doesn't do any of that stuff. So this is one particular view of how we represent the meaning of language, a sort of, if you like, formal view. Now, so a possible meaning for a sentence should take into account both the senses of the words and the syntactic analysis. So we need to come up with several meanings if the sentence is ambiguous. So our famous lovely example, I made her duck, here, ideally, we need to have three representations. One is the one with the sense of the duck, I made her duck, where the analysis here is two sentences, I made her duck, which means I caused her to drop and avert her head. So duck is the action here. This is one representation. I created the duck that she owns, so I made a specific duck for someone. The syntactic structure here is different. We would just have one sentence. And the second one is we made someone a duck. So duck here is a mass noun, so we cooked this poor duck and somebody ate it. Now, providing a semantics for a language, either natural or formal, involves a mapping. A mapping between the structure underlying its string and its meaning. So we have syntax trees now, and we're going to map them into some other representation, which we will call semantics. And so what we will do here is we will learn the translation. How do you go from trees to meaning representations? And it's all like straightforward. There's rules for this. And hey presto, once we use these rules, we can actually model these scope ambiguities. Now, while the kinds of meaning conveyed by natural language are generally more complex than those involved with formal languages, the commonality, if you like, is the fact that they both have the same principle, the principle of compositionality. I don't know if you remember last time we said, you know, every programming language has thinks the basic types, thinks to compose them, and thinks to take them apart. Same in natural language. We will have the building blocks of our meaning, then we will have functions that compose things, and then the composition will give us the representation. So this principle of compositionality is very important, and it's a feature of natural languages, and it turns out of programming languages as well. Now, in programming languages, we impose this, right? We say, look, this is how we're going to do things. In natural languages, it arises, or at least we observe it. This is the beauty of it. Of course, there are several notions. There is strict compositionality and non-strict compositionality. We're not going to get into that. Okay, so what is compositionality? The meaning of a complex expression is a function of the meaning of its parts and the rules by which they're combined. Bear in mind here, we're talking about rules. So this is how the syntax slowly comes into semantics. Rules. What are these rules going to be? Our grammar rules, obviously. So we are not getting rid of syntax. In fact, we're building on top of this. So this is a very syntax-centric view of semantics, as you will see. Now, these are the properties. Okay, so we have the principle of compositionality. This is one thing. So we know, what have I told you so far? That we will create a mapping from these three representations into a formal representation, which we will call meaning. I told you that this meaning has a property called compositionality, which means that smaller expressions will bind together, will combine together to make a larger expression. And now we have to say, we have to wonder, what are the properties of this meaning representation? What do we want from it? And this is much like, you know, if I were to design a programming language, I would have to think about what is its semantics. So what are these properties? The first one, and all these properties are in your book, and rightly so, they're rather important, is verifiability. So one must be able to use the meaning representation of the sentence to determine whether it's true with respect to some model of the world. So this is the so-called truth conditional view of semantics. For example, if I say here, everybody loves Mary, I must be able to verify this. So if I say for this class, everybody loves Mary, do we have a Mary in the audience? No? What a shame. Okay, assume we had a Mary in the audience, and I say everybody loves a Mary, loves Mary. Now, what would the model be? The model would be all of you, including Mary, and I would go and create a table, and I would ask each one of you, do you love Mary, do you love Mary, do you love Mary? And if all of you answer yes, then the meaning of the phrase, of the sentence, I guess, everybody loves Mary, is true. With regard to this model of the students attending Inf2A on Tuesday. Okay? So we have to verify the meaning. It has to be truth or false, true or false, according to a word model. This is the first property. Second property, also very important, that meaning representation should be unambiguous. So that means that we should get only one interpretation. And if our expression is ambiguous, we should get two interpretations. That means we should be able to express ambiguity, if there is such a thing in the expression we are talking about. So in the example, I made her duck, or time flies like an arrow, we should have distinct meaning representations for the distinct meanings we interpret and for the distinct tree structures. And in fact, all three meanings correspond to different tree structures, which means that we would get three different interpretations. Now, this is another important property, canonical form. So the meaning representations of sentences with the same meaning should be convertible into the same representation. This is not rocket science. So if we have two sentences and they have the same meaning, they ought to map into the same representation. Else, what kind of representation is this? For example, if we have the sentence, I filled the room with balloons, and I give it a representation A, then this representation should have the same form with, I put enough balloons in the room to fill it from floor to ceiling. So these two are paraphrases, obviously, and they mean more or less the same thing. It would be very odd if their meaning would be different. Also very reasonable. Now, if you have relationships other than identity, which means if the sentences are not identical, then you must, as an agent and as also a machine, do some inference by entailment or other forms to actually come up to the fact that these two sentences have the same representation. So you as humans can tell right away that I put enough balloons in the room to fill it from floor to ceiling is equivalent to I filled the room with balloons. But a computer would not necessarily know this, so he or she would have to do some work to work it out and then output the same meaning representation. So we said first feature of a meaning representation should be the verifiability. So according to a model, we have to be able to say whether it's true or false. Second was the, what was the second one? An ambiguity. So we have to have different meaning representations for ambiguous expressions. Third, canonical form. Two things with the same two things that express the same meaning should have the same canonical form. And there is a fourth requirement, which is expressivity. Now, and this is the most difficult one, really. The meaning representation should allow a wide range of meanings to be expressed in a natural and revealing way. Now, we'll go back to Chomsky. Remember Chomsky, how he wanted the grammar to be revealing? What did that mean? What does it mean for a grammar to be revealing? It has to be able to capture all the sentences of a natural language, right? It cannot be restricted, and it has to capture them in a way that means something. So it's not like some grammar that is gobbledygook, that I think out of my head and has no bearing whatsoever to any linguistic theory. So it has to be, the meaning representation has to be revealing, has to be natural, and express the relationships that words have. For example, we want to express restrictions on the concept denoted by the head of a phrase. So what is the relationship between brown and cow? If I say brown cow, what does this mean? Think about it for a second. What does it mean to have a brown cow? Okay, you're going to say the cow is brown, but what is it? Is it the set of all brown things and a subset are the cows? Is this the meaning of brown cow?
Just one
say again?
Just one element.
A brown cow could be, yes, it's a cow that is brown. What is the relationship? Are the things that are brown more than the cows that are brown? Yes. So these are things that semanticists worry about. The man who came to dinner is another example. How is the man related to dinner? in the sense that are we talking about any man or a specific man that came to dinner? Walk briskly. Briskly is a feature of walk now. So what is walking briskly different from walk? And in what way? So semantics worry about these subtle distinctions, and the meaning should actually be able to capture them. That is the point about revealing. Another example are here these predicate argument relations. So, and we'll see a lot of that later on. So we have events, and we have participants associated with this event. So if we have a sentence like Fred eats lentils, what is the main event here? Eat. Who are the participants? Fred. Lentils are not participating. Lentils are being eaten, okay? Right, so eating is the event and Fred is the agent. So our meaning should be able to express the fact that here we have one agent and a theme, which is not an agent. It's the object that is being eaten. What about Fred eats lentils with a fork? Now here we have again an eating event. Again, the agent is Fred. Fred is eating lentils, but now the relationship has changed a bit. How is Fred eating the lentils? With his hands? No. He uses a fork. Again, we have to have ways of expressing this. So the point is we can't just have a partial meaning representation and hope for the best. It has to be preserving to what the relationships of the words of the language are. Okay. So now, before I go here, let me ask you a question. How will this meaning look like? We said it's a mapping from strings to something else. What is this something else? What did you do in Inf 1 last year? Did you not do prepositional logic? Did you do any predicate logic, any first order predicate? So these are candidates. We could use those, or maybe we can. We'll see. So now we are moving from, so we've sketched what the requirements for a meaning are. Let's see how we will turn this into a representation. And let's consider first propositional logic, which is nice, simple. You know, we always go simple. Don't go to complicated things. See if the simple things work first. So what does propositional logic do? It's one system for representation and reasoning with expressions. And it's quite nice and simple. It comprises atomic sentences and complex sentences. That's it. P and Q and so on. And the complex sentences that are built from the atomic sentences, the P's and the Q's, and we have logical connectives, things like and, or, not, negation, implies. So here's the question. Can we not use propositional logic to express our semantics, our meaning representation? Let's see. So why not use propositional logic as a meaning representation? So let's take the sentence, Fred ate lentils or he ate rice. This could be represented as P, Fred ate lentils, or he ate rice, Q. What about Fred ate lentils or John ate lentils? So again, we have Fred eating the lentils, so it's P. But here we have a different sentence, John ate lentils, so it would be R. Now look at these two. Is this the right representation for the meaning of those two sentences? Why not? So the first one, Fred ate lentils or ate rice. Who is doing the eating? Fred. In the second one, who is doing the eating? There's two people doing the eating. Does the representation here with the disjunction of the formulas represent this? No. So rubbish. We lose any obvious relationship between the clauses that make up these sentences. Let's look at another example. Everyone ate lentils. So this could be all the people here in this room. P1 and P2 and P3 and P4. Someone ate lentils. It's either P1 or P2 or P3 or P4 or whatever. Now, Does this express the fact that everybody ate lentils? Can we go at infinity and adding these conjunctions? And the second one, we have like a series of disjunctions. This person ate lentils, or this other person ate lentils, and if somebody else comes into the room, we add them to the disjunct problem. So really, we can't express either everybody ate lentils or someone ate lentils. In fact, the fact that we put everything into this one formula is the problem. It's too general. So unfortunately, the simple solution will not work, and we have to look at predicate logic. So what does predicate logic do? First-order predicate logic is closer to being what we need for semantics in natural language. So the sentences here are made up of terms, and you should be familiar with this from the programming languages. We have constant and variable symbols. Nice, we know what to do with those, right? And these symbols represent entities in our world. We have function symbols that allows us to indirectly specify the entities and give us some power, some expressive power. And we have also predicate symbols that express properties of entities and relations that will hold between entities. And the predicates are important because they really represent things like verbs that have arguments, subjects, objects, and whatnot. Now, these are combined, so the symbols, the functions, and the predicate symbols are combined into simple sentences through some rudimentary syntax. And this syntax is not exactly syntax, it's what glues the components together. Remember, we're talking about compositionality. And these are your quantifiers. You know this from propositional logic. So for all and exists, negation, conjunction, disjunction, implication, and equality. Now let's see. So this is the definition. Let's see how this works in practice. So what are the constant symbols? Each constant symbol denotes only one and one entity. So this can be Scotland, Perth, the EU, John, George Bush. Scotland is there twice, sorry. Any person in this class, 2007. So these are constants. These are unique symbols. Now, not all entities have a constant that will denote them. George W. Bush's right knee. How can we denote this? It's not really atomic, you see? This is like a complex expression. This pen. Which pen? This pen would be different for different people. Right? If I say this pen, and then my mother on the phone says this pen, it could be her pen and my pen, and they're two different pens. So they're not unique. That's the whole point. A constant has to be one entity that you can identify, like me. Now, and this is the other thing, several constants may denote the same entity. So it's the inverse problem. There is this star called Venus, and people refer to it as the morning star or the evening star, or Venus. Now, this means that we have several symbols, the morning star, the evening star, and Venus, and they all refer to this point in space, which is Venus, which has this poisonous atmosphere, so I can define now the planet, which is this planet that is very far from the sun. I think actually it's close to the sun. It's one of the closest to the sun, and that has this poisonous atmosphere, and you can't enter it, and if you enter it, you die, and whatnot. So these expressions define this symbol, the same entity. Another example is how we can identify a person by their national insurance number, the student ID, or your name. All these refer to the same entity. So every one of you has a unique national insurance number. Maybe you haven't obtained it. Okay, everybody has a student ID. With that student ID, I can log on to EASE and identify the person that holds the student ID. And with your name, I can do the same. And both of these refer to the same entity. Okay, so we have constants, and then we have predicates. Every predicate has a specific arity. So this is the number of arguments the predicate will take. Arity of one, such as brown, cow, country. Arity of two, live in, we live in somewhere, so somebody lives in somewhere would be arity two. Give, I gave the book to John. There's three arguments there, so the arity is three. And each predicate symbol of arity n is interpreted as a set of n tuples, of entities that satisfy it. So there has to be for give, which has arity three, three different sets of entities that will satisfy it. And in our world model, there would be some entities that do the giving, I, you, she, he. That, and then there would be the recipient of give, another set of entities. And finally, what are we giving? What is the gift? Now, predicates of arity one denote properties. Adjectives, right, are properties. Blue, brown. Predicates of higher order arities denote relations. And these are usually verbal predicates. The relationship of the verb to its subject, its objects, and so on. And then we have variable symbols. And this is good because with variables, you know, we abstract over the specific entities. And we can talk about, you know, larger classes of objects that may have the same properties or the same predicates. So the variable symbols here range over entities. And an atomic sentence with a variable among its arguments only has a truth variable if it's bound by a quantifier. So this expression here, part of x EU, which means that x is part of EU, is unbound. Because we need to have a quantifier that tells us what this x is. Is it some x? Is it all x's? All countries are part of the EU? Or only a subset? So this expression here has a variable that is not bound. Okay, so these are the ingredients of our representation. Now, how do we put them all together? Remember, I said we have quantifiers. We'll see a bit what these quantifiers do. So we have the for all, which is the universal quantifier. It expresses general truths. So for example, the statement cats are mammals, this is a generic statement about cats. There is no way of, you know, unless you do something to the cat in a lab, the cat is a mammal. There is no way about, you know, this is a generic statement about the physiology of cats. So this we would express as, for every cat, it is implied that this cat is a mammal. And this is nice because, you know, the variables are bound. We have the for all statement here. Now, what does this correspond to? What does it mean? Universally quantified sentences correspond to a conjunction of sentences in which the constants substitute for a variable. And it's quite logical if you think about it. So here, if I say, every cat is a mammal, or cats are mammals, I will go and find cat Sam being a mammal, cat Zoot being a mammal, cat Fritz being a mammal, and so on and so forth. And if you add all these cats that are mammals, you'll end up with a statement, cats are mammals. Because you cannot find a cat that is not a mammal. I mean, you could in theory, but not really. Not in the natural world out there. Now, and we're saying that a quantifier has scope, so this for all here has scope over all cats and all mammals. And scope turns out to be important because if you have things that have more than one quantifiers, then you get into scope ambiguities. And things become ambiguous. And we have to worry about what they mean. So we have the universal quantifier and the existential quantifier. These are the two most important ones. What does the existential quantifier do? It's used to express that a property or a relationship holds of some entities, not for everything. And we're not specifying which is the entity that has the property. So I have a cat. Well, there is a cat in the world out there. So here. And I own this cat. So there is an X, and this X is the cat, and I own it. So an existentially quantified sentence would correspond to the disjunction of sentences in which the constant substitutes for the variable, for this x here. So we would go into the real world and find Kat Josephine and me owning it, Kat Zoot and me owning it, Kat Malcolm and me owning it, and so on. So we have all these cats, and the statement, I have a cat, is true because there is at least one cat here from the set of all cats that I own that, yes, that's it. There is a cut from the whole Saint Aignan. Now, bear in mind, here we say there is an X. This X is a cat, and I own it, and I own it. And here we have the implication. For every X, such that X is a cat, this cat is a mama. So the syntax of how we express for all and there is differs. And there is a good reason for this. It's explained in the next slide. So why do we use the conjunction rather than the implication with the existential quantifier? What would this statement mean? There is an X. X is a cat, and therefore, I own it. So it means I own a cat, okay? And there is something that if it's a cat, I own it. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. What if something is not a cat? The problem with the preposition that has the implication is that if you have an implication, it means that the proposition is true even if the antecedent is false. So here the antecedent is this bit here. So even if this is not the case, even if there isn't a cat, the proposition can be true. So there's something that I own. So the proposition is true, even if there is something that's a laptop that exists and that I own. No, that exists. I don't have to own it. So if the antecedent is false, the proposition will be true. And this is a problem. This is a problem. That's why we don't do this with the existentials, because one instance could make the whole thing, one instance of a different kind could make the whole thing true. And this would be nonsensical. The fact that I own a cat shouldn't be truly simple for the reason that I have a laptop. Okay, clicker questions. Let me get the clickers out. Where are the clickers now? Okay, I'll read it out to you. Which one of the sentences below does not correspond to the formula? For every X such that X is a cow, it follows that X is domesticated and bovine. So which of the following sentences does not correspond to this representation? Every cow is a domesticated bovine. A cow is a domesticated bovine. Every domesticated bovine is a cow. A cow is domesticated and a bovine. Have a think. And remember, these are generic statements about cows, irrespective of the fact that we have A. We don't talk about a single cow, we talk about cows in general. Even though we say a cow is a domesticated bovine, in the same way that we say a cat is a mammal. Oh, God.
Yeah, okay.
Good. That's correct. That's correct. Do I need to explain this or the class? I'll brief it. Very nice. Very nice. Today the class is awake. Good. Good. Did Paul teach before me here? Was Paul here? Okay. Now, no, I feel sometimes the class is very tired. No, it has nothing to do with Paul, but I feel like, you know, I come in and you guys sit like that. And I'm fully aware it's the last lecture of a long day. And I go like, how are these guys gonna wake up? You have one more. Who designed this? What class is that? You have another? I didn't realize this. Okay, right. Okay, I'm not the last one. Yay! Right. So let me explain. So the first one is clear. It's exactly right. Every cow is a domesticated bovine. So for every cow, the cow is domesticated and bovine. A cow is a domesticated bovine. It's the same, but we don't have every. We have a. It's a generic statement about cows. Every domesticated bovine is a cow is wrong because here we don't have a for all of x such that x is a bovine. We talk about cows. So this the syntax is wrong. It doesn't correspond. And a cow is domesticated and a bovine is the same as a cow is a domesticated bovine, except that I have expressed it as a conjunction. Second question. Where's the second question now? Gone to rest. Which of the following expression corresponds to the sentence, every dog has a bone? For every x, there is a y. X is a dog, and y has a bone. So for every x that x is a dog, this x will have a bone. For every y, there is a y, it is a dog and has a bone. For every x, has a bone, there is a y. For every x that has a bone, there is a y, and this y is a dog. For every x, there is a y, which is a dog, and a y. So you all know it's not four. Okay, I'll press the button. Exactly. Okay, good. So this is the right interpretation. There is an x that this x is a dog, and for every dog, there is a y, such that y is a bone and the dog has it. This is wrong. Number two is wrong because we don't have the for all. So it's not the representation, it's wrong. This has flipped dog and bone, so it's also nonsensical. And the last one is simply like you can't get this formula. This is unbound, right? It doesn't have a predicate. No, it is bound. It is bound to the existential, but doesn't have a predicate. It's just a variable looking for something. Now, we have a choice. So the next bit is actually rather, yes?
Let's just say that y is a bone. Yeah. Why does it say that the dog has a bone?
There is a dog for every dog, and this dog, I should have a put predicate, has a bone. So he's absolutely right. So nothing changes except that this one is not bone, just bone. It's has bone. Okay? That's the only thing. But thank you very much. This is absolutely right. This is absolutely right. So this should be has bone rather than bone. So no, none of the clicker questions is right. But thank you very much. Now, we have a choice here in how to follow the class. So the next bit is actually really important. It's on semantic composition, which means how do we actually build these structures. And it has lots of formulas and lots of lambdas. And if the class is tired, I'd rather stop here and start from this point on Thursday so that you are awake. Okay? Unless you guys object. I'd rather do that and let you go, because this is kind of important material. It's all over the place in the exam. So I want a non-tired class. Are there any questions? No? Everything is clear? Okay. All right. See you Thursday. Hello.
this is Frank Keller, and he says he will talk to you both, so the read is Paul Jackson. And Paul is not an experienced disorder, but Paul is senior boss, which means he's like top of the, like he's the boss of the DOS.
Okay, so should I tell Paul about it? Is that, I'm sure if I should tell Paul about it.
Yes, you should tell Paul, but you know, you talk to people and you talk to Stuart, who is like the boss, of their boss. Stuart is the head of teaching. And he needs to contest all of his decisions, what he considered. Whether they would actually give you the thing, they wouldn't allow you to go. Like, they have to consider your case, whether you can potentially go. Don't go, it's a different matter.
I don't know what. I've never spoken to
them. No, but the college of engineering has been something you're in and saying you don't want to.
They, well, so what the international office said that they said no. I don't know why.
Well, he should see, they should give you a reason, at least.
Yeah, I wasn't.
Yeah, so, but then what will you do if they don't actually, if they give you a reason?
Well, then if I can't go, they give me a reason. And it's like, you know, it's a reason that makes sense. I asked Stuart about it, and he said that it doesn't make any sense because I've already done one of his clearances at the university.
And you probably shouldn't have transferred.
Yeah, okay. So he says that it doesn't make sense to think. They can't judge my.
When did you talk to Stuart? Then?
I talked to him.
Good. He has like this session where the students can talk to him. I don't know. You have a tutorial. Okay, good. So, but somebody needs to take it up with the College of Engineering. I somehow feel it won't be Stuart because he's very busy. So you need to go through your doors, be extra nice to him and say, you know, I have this problem, blah, blah, blah. Have an appointment with him. And he needs to take it up with them. Okay, no problem. That's exactly what the head of teaching told me. Frank, deputy head. Okay, so there's a head and a deputy. Is there a question?
I'm actually a visiting student,
right?
So for the homework assignment, it requires us to know Haskell. I've never written a line of functional programming in my entire life. I glanced over the grammar and I spent like 20 minutes on an introductory Haskell website. It didn't seem too bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, I haven't done full programming.
Email John and tell him, look, I haven't done Haskell, I'm a visiting student.
Do you think that it requires, you have to really understand what Haskell's doing to do? Okay.
But I want him to tell you this.
Okay.
Right? So email him and say exactly this, and, you know, do I need to, like, do a crash course on Haskell, or can I go get by with this? It's not so terribly difficult.
It didn't look too difficult.
No, just make sure, send him an email, and no problem.
I'm going to ask for all that's going to be very much. Like, Like the second time I came back, it was crazy. Like, it was so confusing. that's not true. Like, you know, Jim Martin is smiley, but
I still think it's smart.
Yeah.